Social justice means applying the law equally to all people. But in practice, that doesn't always happen. I'm John Gonzalez. I'm here at my law partner, Jack DeRora. We practice law. We seek social justice. On this show, we reveal the conflict between the two.
You know, for a while, it was just us in the office over a cup of coffee talking about the news of the day. With social justice issues dominating our culture, our focus became how do we as lawyers make a difference?
And now it's not just us. Today we have Steve Kahn. He's a W.E. Smith Professor of History at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He's the author of 7 books, including the most recent, The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is. Steve is here to discuss, what does Jerry Jones know about coaching the Dallas Cowboys? Or maybe more importantly, what does Vivek Ramaswamy know about being governor of Ohio? Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Jack, I think I might have told you that during Mitt Romney's run for the presidency, Ann and I, mostly Ann, was a part of his followers politically, and it seemed to me that he couldn't manage to go a month without showing his rich guy cluelessness about the way the other 99% of us lived. And I think back now to maybe a different time in our society, because his personal wealth was about $250 million, which in terms of the people that hang out with our current president is nothing, right?
Right.
But it seems to me that at that time, Mr. Romney tried to shield his wealth and pretend like he wasn't rich. And now, as a society, it seems to me that we revere people with this great wealth. We mistake it to equality. We mistake it and equal it to great wisdom or, you know, great humanity or great intellect. Do you agree with that?
I think that's how we do see it. Absolutely.
And so, which brings us to why we were interested in Steve coming to visit us, because he wrote a wonderful article in the Dispatch talking about how very wealthy people seem to think that they know everything.
Yeah, it's really amazing how often we see that.
And the example of Jerry Jones, who I was listening to my sports show on the way over here today, and they were talking about Jerry's new coach for the Dallas Cowboys, and they actually were playing clips of Jones talking about how what a great person this is, what he's going to, you know, he's going to make a great coach. But what is it, Steve, about our society that we give ultra wealthy people kind of a pass on, you know, whether they actually know what they're doing or not?
Yeah, I think I'll start by saying you're absolutely spot on. I think that's a diagnosis of what's going on in our culture right now. But I'm the historian in the room, so I'm going to have to say there are historical roots to this. I think if we go back to the Gilded Age 1.0, there were similar kinds of figures who thought they could preside magisterially over lots and lots of different things, especially transferring the fact that they'd made a lot of money into crafting social policy. And I'm thinking about the Morgans and the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts and so on and so forth. I think that disappeared. Or let's say it receded into the background a little bit during the middle decades of the 20th century. One of the little data points I like to use is that Fortune magazine first published its Fortune 500, the 500 or maybe it's 400 wealthiest people in the country, I think early in the 1970s. And people who were on that list sued Fortune because they didn't want this information revealed. Nowadays, people fight if they're not on the list, because we've flipped our attitudes about wealth and wealthy people.
Well, I have to, you know, give wealthy people some respect. I mean, even the ones, to me, deserve it more are the ones that made it themselves. It wasn't the inherited wealth, but it was the people that started a business and even if they had money to seed it, but they made it big. And I think of you know, like the company Apple or the company Nike. The owners of those companies were good businessmen. I don't know. What do you think, Jack? I mean,
I think that's true. And we had, you know, we have here Worthington Steel and John McConnell. Supposedly, he was a poor man from West Virginia with one truck selling coal, and somehow he morphed that into Worthington Steel. So it does happen. Although, as wealthy and well-known, and I suppose influential as John McConnell was, may peace be upon him, you didn't hear people looking at him as the omniscient one for what was good for Columbus. If it was said, it was done quietly, not in the way that we hear Elon Musk or Vivek talk about what's wrong with America. It's an interesting comparison, I think, and I think a valid comparison.
Well, I always get the argument from people I talk to about, you know, what makes a Donald Trump a good president? Well, he was a successful businessman, and I keep thinking, well, I'm not sure that equates to running the country, right. But maybe we should talk about whether he was really a successful businessman, right? And what I like to say is, well, how do you deal with the bankruptcies? Mm-hmm. And the argument is, well, see how smart he is? Yep. He's allowed to use the law to his advantage. And, you know, I can't argue that there's some business smarts there, but just trying to equate that to the world of politics. And did you see the inauguration at all, where we had the lineup of Elon Musk?
Yep.
And
Bezos,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And I would think if I had that kind of money, that would probably be the last place I would be.
Well, so I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit. I'm pretty confident that being a good businessman does not at all necessarily translate into being good for government. And I'll put it crudely. If you're Jeff Bezos, your job has been to make Amazon a profitable company. That's your sole goal. There's one variable here. And you don't think much about the adverse consequences of what that might entail, like all the mom-and-pop shops that get driven out of business and, you know, bricks-and-mortar retail that are now going under because of e-commerce. That's not your concern, because you're concerned with a single variable. How do I make this company profitable? If you are in government in a allegedly democratic society, ipso facto, your charge is to do the greatest good for the greatest number. So it's really a rare businessman who can transcend that sort of single focus on running a business and begin to see the much broader picture of society as a whole. You do have to worry about the rise of e-commerce and all the people in the shopping malls being put out of business, right? If you're the mayor or the governor or the president, you have to be concerned about that. So I don't, and if we look at people who came to the presidency from business, and I'm thinking really in the modern era from the Civil War forward, we don't have that many, for starters, and the track record isn't that great. Herbert Hoover, not so great. George W. Bush, not so good. And the current one, you may remember George W. Bush campaigned in 2000. He was going to be the MBA president. He had an MBA from Harvard. And 7 years later, we had the greatest financial meltdown, well, since Herbert Hoover, as a matter of fact. So I actually, I don't think that this, you know, business success translates into government success necessarily at all. Can I follow up on something else as well, Gonzo? Just that I think you're right that what Americans have always admired is the entrepreneurial part of business, right? I think we've always been, we were once upon a time uneasy about inherited wealth. The story, that sort of rags-to-riches American tale, is originally created by Benjamin Franklin. In his autobiography. Sorry, I'm a historian. I got to do this, guys. It's just what I do. And if you haven't read the autobiography recently, it's a great read. It's one of my favorite books. I love to teach it. Franklin tells the story of the poor kid who makes good. hard work, steady habits. He gives you the schedule. He gets up at 5 o'clock every morning and so on and so forth. But the part that people often miss is that he, at various points in his narrative, acknowledges all the people who helped him. This rich person who gave me introductions here, which enabled my success in this particular venture. He had patrons, he had sponsors, and he was absolutely upfront about that. One of the things I think that you see that's kind of interesting is the way in which a number of these current-day plutocrats want to portray themselves as the rags-to-riches story, including Donald Trump, who will now tell you he never got anything much. Well, he got a little bit, not too much from his father. That business was worth, in today's dollars, almost $500 million when he inherited it in the mid-70s. So even people like Trump want to pretend that they made it on their own.
That's a really interesting subject because I'll compare that to Colin Powell, a millionaire, right? So you never hear, at least I haven't, Bezos or Musk, take your pick of wealthy people, talk about who helped them. But Colin Powell would always talk about the people, about the blacks who were in the army before him who made it possible.
That's right.
He was really interesting in that he said, look, if it hadn't been for the Buffalo Soldiers in the late 1800s, I may not be here. Yep. And that always stood out to me.
Well, I think I remember that as well. Some people even portrayed that as a kind of humbleness or modesty, which maybe it was, but it was also just a recitation of facts about his own story, which I admired. I would also just note, we've had a fair number of former generals as presidents. Their track record is better as president than our businessmen presidents, because as a general, you do have to see a bigger picture. You worry about your foot soldiers over here. You worry about geopolitics over there. You have to have a much broader vision of the world than you do running a business.
You anticipated what I wanted to ask you, Steve, because you think about, and I've thought about it with Donald Trump, he runs his business and he's the ultimate decision maker. He's more of a dictator in business, right? And so then you come to government and government's a lot about compromise. And Trump just has shown no ability to want to compromise, right?
Right.
Because he probably never had to do that being on top of the Trump empire. But then you think about the generals that have run our country and you think, well, they're at the top and nobody really questions them. What was your saying once, Jack, there's nothing impossible for the admiral?
I don't know if I said that. I may have said that, but certainly, one of the foundations of officer training is taking care of the troops.
Right.
That's foundational. In fact, they would always talk, before you do anything, make sure that, back in the day when I was in the service, make sure the troops are fed, make sure they're trained, make sure they're paid, make sure they get their mail.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, so then you think of somebody like Eisenhower. It must have been difficult for him, though, to have to compromise when he's been in a position of authority his whole, most of his professional life. But as you say, they seem to make better presidents than our businessmen.
Yeah. We can start with George Washington, who was in a position to make himself king. I really believe people in Philadelphia would have done that, or at least ruler for life, if that's what he had wanted to do. And as a general, right, you think, he'd been in charge of everything here, and he'd won. But in fact, no, he steps back, right? That's the great contribution of Washington, is in a sense to create what we mean by a democratic chief executive. He invents that peaceful transition to power, stepping away, et cetera, et cetera. And then, the last one, Eisenhower. Eisenhower's track record working with Congress, pretty good. Not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But in fact, I think Eisenhower claimed he had never voted before he voted for himself in 1952. I think he said that as a way of insisting that he didn't really care much about partisanship. I think what he said was, okay, this is my task now. I have to move into this role, and that role entails working with other people who I might disagree with. And I think you're right. As far as the current president, he's going to want to rule as much by executive order as anything else.
You know, another thing interesting about Eisenhower, if I'm not mistaken, when he left the presidency, didn't he state his own concern about the harm, not the harm, but he offered a cautionary tale about the industrial military complex becoming too important. Now, that's an interesting statement from the former Supreme Allied commander saying, we've got this industrial military complex, let's be careful.
You're absolutely right. It's his farewell address, January of 1961, where he coins that phrase, the military-industrial complex. In fact, Eisenhower had been saying similar things in speeches throughout his presidency. He's the one who crafted the phrase, I'm not going to get it right. Every warship that is launched, every missile that is fired represents a theft from those who are hungry and not fed. I mean, it sounds like some kind of crazy left-wing Quaker, but he's giving a speech in front of a bunch of journalists. And I think it's precisely because he had seen what war is really all about, that he had a certain kind of wisdom, or at least experience, to know you don't want to do this again. So you're absolutely right about Eisenhower.
You know, I saw... Did you have something to say? I didn't mean to talk over you, Gonzo. This notion of business people being good government officials comes with this notion, as you've pointed out, Steve, that business people have one mission, profitability. And maybe this singular focus is what causes some very far-right writers like Curtis Yarvin. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Curtis Yarvin is interesting. I listened to a podcast where he was interviewed, and he thinks autocracy is the way to go. Now, there's no question that in an autocracy, you get things done pretty quickly.
Yep.
China's a great example of that. People were riding bicycles 50 years ago. Yep. Now they got bullet trains. But that seems to be an outgrowth of people in business know how to get things right.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of things that we want in government. But as you've pointed out, when you're in business, you've got one concern. If you're running the government, you should have about 50 concerns. Yeah. And we fail to see that.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. You know, look, democratic governance, quote Winston Churchill, it's a terrible form of government except for all the alternatives. And I think there is, and I am reluctant to make this analogy, so forgive me ahead of time, but it's not purely coincidental that during the Third Reich, the relationship between Germany's big businesses and that government was very cozy, because I think there are, in a certain direction, you move down a certain road too far, and the principle of autocratic rule becomes appealing both to politicians, to some military figures, and to business figures as well. Lots of those business leaders in Germany were quite happy to have a dictator again.
That is a dictator who saw things their way.
Correct. That's right.
Well, if we're not already there, we're certainly moving to this place in our country where, I mean, we have oligarchy, right?
Yeah.
We have rich people that are buddies with the president, who's also rich. And so, you know, sometimes I think, Steve, could Trump do what we're thinking he should? And he just doesn't want to, right? I mean, I don't know if it's a problem that Trump probably could be more compassionate. He could think about 50 things instead of just one. But does he really want to when he has buddies like Elon Musk or Zuckerberg saying, wait a minute, we want to make money. That's the point.
Let me correct you.
I'm not joking.
I'm not joking when I say this. And forgive me for going down the political road. He doesn't have the ability to be compassionate. That's not within his toolkit. He knows only what is good for himself. Continue, Mr. Gonzalez.
Well, that put a button into it.
Well, so, isn't that what his own sister has said in
setting aside our psychoanalytic minds here for a minute, I just think that some of the people that are wealthy could actually govern in a very humane, general way, right, to benefit all of us. But I just don't think they really want to. And I go back to this oligarchy kind of system, because if I think about what that means, and I always think about the Russians, it's a very few people governing for their own benefit.
Yeah.
And isn't that what's starting to happen?
Well, I think, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'll be quick. I think we see that with the tech industry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I listened to an interview with a gent named Mark Andreessen. Am I saying that correctly? Big tech guy on the West Coast. And from what I was reading, the tech leaders were largely Democrats. For reasons that I can't remember, they felt like the Democrats were abandoning them in terms of pursuit of AI, not regulating tech industry, and then started to regulate the tech industry and do things that they saw weren't good. And so they leapt to Trump. They leapt to Trump, whatever that verb is, not because of his overall qualities for America, but they had one thing in mind, you know, their own place in society. So they that's all they care about.
I would agree with that. I think what you're watching or have been watching for, well, probably for close to 40 years, is the use of the law. Yes, I mean, this is a law podcast.
Right.
couple of lawyers in here, right? But other sorts of structures to insulate those wealthy people from the rest of us, to remove those kinds of industries from any kind of democratic control. And that's not just in this country. This is a global phenomenon. In some ways, that's what globalization and what some people call the neoliberal economy is all about. It is to remove democracy from the economy. And so we can fight about, school curricula, and we can fight about other sorts of trivial matters, but these people want to be insulated. And the tech industry, right, is the sort of behemoth of the moment. And I think that's right. I think what you have are a collection increasingly of what I would identify as libertarians who just don't think they owe anything to anybody, never mind, again, how they may have made their money or who they needed to help with to start with. And so they resent all things about democracy. I think you see this with Peter Thiel, who J.D. Vance is a sort of wholly owned subsidiary of Thiel Industries. And he has said, I don't like democracy. He said this out loud. And so I think that's a real risk that we face right now.
I love the way you refer to Vance as a wholly owned entity.
Well, I mean, how much money did he give in that senatorial campaign in 2020? It was a lot of money.
You know, it is an example of nothing else that one fortuitous step can change the entire direction of your life. I mean, he went to the venture capital world after law school and was propelled in a way that comes like one out of a million shots.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's another thing that Americans, and this is historically speaking, when we think about those narratives, those entrepreneurial narratives, those rags to riches, those wealthy man must have really earned it sort of things, we're not very good at reckoning with luck, both good and bad. Plenty of people in society work really hard. But for whatever reason, right, luck, circumstance, and so forth, they don't make it in the same way. But we don't quite want to attribute luck as a factor in people's success.
I think we've always recognized that voters vote self-interest most often, abortion, immigration, those types of issues. And what we're talking about are these influencers like Musk or Zuckerberg or whoever. Again, they're trying to influence for their own self-interest. But I see it now going a step further And I don't think that's an oligarchy. I think the oligarchies want to run things. They're mm-hmm. not just there like a lot of our wealthy people or even special interest groups where they're just trying to influence for their bottom line. I get the feeling like we're getting into where these very, very wealthy people actually want to run things. I don't know any other way to describe Elon Musk. And I get that if we do something to get to Mars, he's probably going to be the one that profits from that. But I also think he's just decided that he's wealthy enough and smart enough that he should be in charge.
Well, he's wealthy enough and therefore believes that he's smart enough. I guess what I find remarkable, and we could sort of put together a list of people who fall in this category, is this really remarkable combination of arrogance and ignorance. They go together in extraordinary ways. And I never thought I would be quoting Donald Rumsfeld at this moment, but his famous quote about making sure you know the things you don't know. Mm-hmm. These are people who are not interested at all, are incurious, fundamentally incurious about the things they do not know, which is a vast, vast amount.
And that's, I always bark about the human condition in our podcast, but incurious is a beautiful word, and I think that is part of the human condition. Mm. Not enough people are. And when the two of you were just talking, I thought, man, is wealth and hubris are directly related. Wealth and humility are inversely related.
Well, you know, this is, excuse me, one more thing.
And as humility increases, so does curiosity.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're not humble and you think you know it all, you're never asking all the right questions.
That's right. I think that's right. And yeah, I mean, you've put your finger on a whole other strand of this conversation, which is how it is that American, mostly evangelicals, mostly Protestants, have made their peace with, you know, the camel going through the eye of a needle and the rich man not getting into heaven. A whole other story for maybe another time, but that's a fascinating development as well. I think that the ability to ask those questions, yeah, I think is part of it's what Socrates defines as wisdom, is to say, I don't know things. I better ask some more questions. And when somebody tells you they've got all the answers and not all the questions, yeah, you should run for the exits.
How do you contrast somebody like Bill Gates, though? He's mm-hmm. an ultra-rich person who, at least from the reports I read, is interested in humanity. He's an influencer sure. with all his money, and so is his ex-wife. But it's more like in the healthcare area and things like that. It's the things that the three of us probably believe that are very good for us.
I'm anti-malaria. Yeah, yes, right, I will right. go on. A controversial position maybe, but yeah, so I'm against.
So the difference between someone like that and Elon Musk, to me, it's outside of politics. But they're still influencers. They're still using their money in a way they think they're smart enough to make change.
So great. That's a great comparison. I think, first of all, there's a tiny bit of generational here. Gates is just a little older than the Zuckerbergs and the Musks and the kind of the tech crowd that has come in. You know, he made his money with Microsoft with operating systems. These people are making their money on social media apps, right? So it's a different generation technologically, but also chronologically. And I think Gates is among the last rich people in the country who still, in a sense, follow the gospel of wealth as it was written out by Andrew Carnegie in the early 20th century. Carnegie was adamant that he would die penniless. And he wrote this book, a great book, interesting book, where he said, if you die rich, you're a failure. And he said he was absolutely opposed to inherited wealth of any kind. He did actually make it on his own. A lot of help, a lot of circumstances, but nonetheless, he was a poor kid from Scotland. And he's the guy who invents what we think of as modern philanthropy. And you can see just a brilliant example of it not too far from here. The main branch of the Columbus Public Library is a Carnegie library. He built.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yes, it is. 1,700 libraries his initiative built by about the First World War. And not just in cities like Columbus, but in tiny little towns all across the Midwest, there's a Carnegie Library. There it is. So he had a sense that you had to give back. And Gates, I think, has that same sense. Now, we can argue about how you do that. Gates, rather than thinking he can cure malaria, has spent his money finding experts. And I think that's another, this is, I think, goes along with your humility observation, that a number of these sort of plutocrats have no regard for expertise other than their own. And in fact, they're scared of it a little bit. That this is why Trump surrounds himself with sycophants and bootlickers, because he doesn't want to be in a room with people who are smarter than he is. He's too scared and too insecure. And I think that's a common phenomenon. Expertise, and this is why we're going after, you know, the public health experts and all this other sort of stuff. We are suspicious of people who are smarter than we are.
You know, I never thought of, I've heard that before, and people who will, management people who are suspicious of hiring anybody of equal intelligence for fear of them being dislodged. But I never thought about it in the national context. That's really interesting.
Well, an old colleague of mine had an adage, A people hire A people, B people hire C people. And I think what we have is a collection of C people coming to Washington right now.
Well, the question I have, though, is are Americans okay with this?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them voted for Trump.
Yep.
And, you know, you start to think, if we go back to our cowboy analogy, there's a lot of cowboy avid fans, no matter what Jerry Jones has been doing all these years. So you kind of have to ask yourself, you know, is this the beginning? And I don't think it'll happen in our lifetime, that we really are changing the way that American politics are going to be viewed. And it's going to be more dictatorial or the oligarchy or all these things that seem bad, at least to us, but not to a lot of Americans.
So I'm going to evade that question a little bit. I'm going to come at it from a slightly different angle. One of the things that has fascinated me as a kind of broad cultural shift is how we define popularly what we mean by the word elite. Really, up until the 1970s and 80s, that word meant rich. And in 1936, when Franklin Roosevelt is campaigning for his second term, he gives a speech in which he denounces the economic royalists. I mean, it's a great speech. It's about a month before the election. And he's attacking these rich people as enemies of the people. They want to protect their privilege. They want to protect it at your expense. I mean, it's a barn burner. If you want to, it's out there online. You can go look this one up. And then at some point in the late 20th century, elite came to mean education. It came to mean certain kinds of cultural markers. You read a book. You go to a concert.
You live on the West Coast.
You live on a coast. That's right. And it no longer meant rich, wealthy, plutocrat. And so that's how it is that somebody like Trump gets to campaign as a populist. And somebody like Barack Obama, raised by a single mother, or Bill Clinton, for that matter, raised by a single mother in poverty in Arkansas, becomes an elite. I think that's fascinating. And I think it does speak to your question of what do Americans, do they resent these rich people, or do they really just want to be like them?
You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking the other day how easy it is to criticize someone as an elite.
Yep.
But no senator should ever accuse anyone else of being an elite, because you've got to be walking around in elite circles to just get your campaign started.
Sure.
There's no such thing as getting into the race unless, I don't know, you got 100 friends who can give you $1,000 apiece.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's absolutely right. And it's right, the theatrics of this, the posturing of it, if you pay even a little attention to it, it's pretty maddening. Because right, there's no logic here. There's no factual basis for some senator to accuse somebody else of being an elite. Are you kidding me?
I hadn't thought about this idea that elites now are, you know, the educated people. Let's pause there for a minute. I always tell Jack about my neighbor who is a avid MAGA Trump supporter, and it just happened to be that at one point in his life, he was living in the basement. And I read an article that one of Trump's, you know, constituency base is white, non-educated men who live in the basement. And so I was teasing him about that. And while we laugh about things that he tells me, I do think there's a resentment there, not that he's living in the basement, but that he didn't go to college and that these college guys feel like they're better than him.
Yeah.
Because I know that he is a smart guy, and I never try to diminish his intellect, but he doesn't have a degree, right?
Yep.
So he's, you know, like the Scarecrow in Wizard of Oz, right?
Right.
Like, you're smart, you just don't have a degree.
Yeah.
But he does resent it, and he's admitted to that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that this is connected to larger shifts in the economy over which nobody really had a whole lot of control or certainly didn't see coming. You know, and you know the story as well as I do. If you came out of World War II, took advantage of the GI Bill, bought a house in the suburbs, and went to work at a plant, at a Ford plant or a U.S. Steel plant or something like that, worked there your whole life, making a union wage, you were middle class. You went on summer vacations. You might have even had a beach house. And that world shrank dramatically in the 1970s, at which point people started saying, well, gee, if you want to get ahead in this economy, you need a college degree, because that's where the economy is shifting. And I do think that that left a number of people, for whatever reason, either were not disposed to go to college or couldn't hack it in college or whatever, left them feeling both precarious and therefore resentful.
Mm-hmm. My understanding, though, is that college and law school admissions are going back up. Now, I don't know if that's just a matter of having no place to go in the workforce, right? But, you know, you wonder what is the value of that kind of thing. And in our family, we have people that have done very well that have never been to college.
Mm-hmm.
We have others that have been to college and aren't economically doing very, very well.
Right.
And so when I talk to my kids about it, yeah, I mean, it's not just all about college, right?
Yeah.
It's about working hard and doing the right things. But I think that Trump and Vivek and J.D. Vance are smart, and they know that resentment is the key to being elected.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in some ways, it used to be a kind of truism in American presidential politics that you had to smile if you were going to win. And that was Reagan, right? That was Reagan's magic, was that even though the economy was terrible in his first administration, even though Iran-Contra, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, he smiled through it all, and people responded to it. And if you were constantly, you know, aggrieved and angry, you were not going to have a political future. And I think that is not the case anymore. I mean, I think that's clear. Grievance turns people out to the polls.
Regrettable, but true. but you know what? That's still an entirely different conversation from what we started off talking about, which is the people who are now the robber barons of the 21st century. And I think that's a pretty big deal and something that we're going to have to contend with and doesn't bode well for the nation.
Well, I think when you said that the tech people have started to switch their political allegiance, it has all to do with, not singularly, but certainly it has a great deal to do with Democrats who began to say, we need to regulate this stuff.
Right.
Now, most Americans probably also think that they don't want their 12-year-olds seeing things on TikTok or I don't do this stuff. I don't know what I'm talking about here. Mm-hmm. I stay away from it all. But we have gotten to a point, and these people take advantage of it, where we think regulating anything in the economy must be bad for the economy. I mean, never mind clean water, clean air, and everything else that we regulated in the 70s and benefit from now. And I think that so just to come back to Bill Gates and philanthropy for a moment, the difference that I see, because, you know, Mark Zuckerberg gives away a lot of money as well, but they want to control that money. They believe that they have a better way of doing philanthropy than their predecessors. And philanthropy in this country always has to be, it seems to me, a yes and proposition. You got to pay your taxes, and you got to actually pay more taxes. And you can do philanthropy if you want. You can't substitute the one for the other, which is something you hear quite a lot of, these billionaires who think, I can spend the money better. I can be more effective than government. But I will guarantee you will never visit a water treatment plant sponsored by a philanthropist. And yet every one of us relies on a water. Who's going to build those if nobody's paying their taxes, right? That's I think, right, like those sort of basic public infrastructure that we all take for granted.
For some reason, from what I gleaned from the news, those at the very top of the economic pyramid somehow just think that they shouldn't be bothered with taxes.
That's correct.
And
yes.
Maybe that's because of what you're saying. I never thought of it this way before, that, well, they'll make it up in philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. I'm not buying that.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't buy it just on the numbers don't even add up. I mean, it's still the case that as a percentage of income, middle class and even lower middle class people give more than the top 1%. It's just that you hear about the big donations to a hospital or to a university or whatever because it makes a big splash. But I think you're absolutely right. They don't think they should have to contribute really at all to what we might broadly call the public.
So we've got to bring our conversation to an end, although I think Gonzo and I would enjoy talking with you for hours. So let me ask you the tough question. Based on historical trends, what do we see in the future with the robber barons and our fixation on wealth? Fixation on wealth.
Fixation,
I
yeah.
I didn't say it the right
so
way.
So I'm going to preface my answer by saying I'm a historian. I have a hard enough time getting the past right. I'm not so good predicting the future, though I will also add I'm better than most economists. I just don't get paid as much as they do. I want to believe, and I think I can make a case for this, that the kind of whatever are the impulses that are burning through American politics right now will burn themselves through. I do think that to some extent, one way to understand the Trump phenomenon is to think about the kind of old Maoist cult of personality, and it doesn't survive the end of the personality. So I think that's one way to look at this. I do think that in terms of reining in the economic power and influence that let's just call it the 1% or the 10% of the 1%. That's going to require a considerable amount of political muscle that can only come, I think, from Congress, not even the presidency necessarily. And do I imagine that happening? I guess I can, but that seems a long way off to me. That seems far away.
I would agree wholeheartedly. I think about the robber barons of the past, and probably one of the things that reined in that power was Congress at the time.
Yeah, and that's right.
I just am disappointed and see such a void of leadership in our Congress.
Oh, I think
You think about our Speaker of the House or the Senate President. They have no more leadership in our. It's hard to even find people in Congress that'll do anything other than what Trump or what Biden wanted at the time. And until that leadership comes back and they're kind of this independent body, I don't think it's going to start to get better. But I agree with you. It can.
Yeah. No, I think it can. But I also would agree with you that let's just say that I don't know that there are too many congresspeople I can think of right now who are going to wind up on Mount Rushmore. I don't see a Mount Rushmore class in this particular collection.
I had wrote a note and I was going to save it for after our discussion, but I'm starting to tease people that are MAGA frenzied people that when is it that Trump's going to sell the naming rights for the Gulf of Mexico or Mount Rushmore or, you know, because, they may not make it there, but somebody's name may make it somewhere.
Right,
but
right.
Steve, we appreciate you coming in.
Oh, it's thanks so much.
So much fun. And yeah, we got to have him back.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
It really was a good conversation. Thanks so much. Our thanks to WOSU and our sound engineer, Dalton Jones. If you like what you've heard, tell a friend. We want it to be more than just us. We want it to be all of us. We'll be back soon with another social justice issue. Until then, so long.